Okay, so this is April 2nd, 2000, A Tale of Two Kingdoms, Part 19. This lesson is tentatively entitled, James Grows Up for Better or Worse, Mostly Worse. Okay, so we left off last time. Morton had been arrested on New Year's Eve, 1580. I kind of fast-forwarded, he had a trial at the end of May, where he was judged to have been guilty of ardent part of the murder of King Henry. And on the 2nd of June, he was executed with a device that sounds something like a guillotine. And apparently he installed it, and apparently that was its first use. So, you know, how's that for irony? So, about the same time, sort of the events leading up to Morton being deposed, arrested, and so on, there's quite a Catholic scare in the country. Now, today, you know, we have a hard time imagining what a Catholic scare might be like. But keep in mind that, you know, the outcome of the Reformation was still in the balance, as it were, or, you know, at least appeared to be if you were living at that time. And the outcome wasn't probably as certain as it might appear in retrospect. So some of this was probably caused by the widely known influence of Esme Stuart, the Earl of Lennox, on the court, on the king. He was perceived, and probably was, an agent of the Duke of Guise and the Pope. There were French visitors to Edinburgh frequently, and it's believed anyways that probably this sort of triggered stories of the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre. There are plenty of rumors of Catholic plots to convert or depose the king, as well as murder Elizabeth, and at the same time there were plots going on to try to restore Mary to the throne, or maybe even restore her elevator to Elizabeth's throne. A number of previously banished Catholics came home. In England, there was a well-known Jesuit priest. They were traveling amongst the people. They were saying masses to crowds of people. Some of them were arrested. There's a story about one of them being, saying a mass at somebody's house. And agents of the queen, surrounded the house, and they charged in, and they looked at form everywhere and couldn't find them. Finally, tapping on a wall, they found this spot that sounded hollow, and there were three priests hidden behind this secret passage. A question of fact. Yes, Mr. Fisher.
England or Scotland?
Well, both. But, I mean, Scotland specifically, but stories from England, of course, are also flying back and forth. And also, Queen Elizabeth's ambassador to Scotland was repeating this news from England. And then finally, there were some dispensations which permitted Catholics to pretend to be Protestants as long as they advanced the Roman faith secretly. And these were intercepted and then made known. So there was sort of a fear of hidden papists, if you will. And then finally, James apparently, this is quoting from James Hewison King, writing about the turn of the last century. 1580, James apparently learned that his alleged perversion was the subject of common gossip. In 1580, the king converted his household into a regular congregation or pastorate and ordained that the church was to have full jurisdiction in his palaces. John Craig was appointed one of his chaplains, a remarkable preferment since Craig was one of the most outspoken of the original leaders. Right? And John Craig was actually the one who had not refused, but strongly resisted issuing marriage bans for Mary and the Earl of Bothwell. So, James apparently felt like there was some spin doctoring that he had to do. And he and his household subscribed what's called the King's Confession. It's also been called John Craig's Confession, the National Covenant, the Second Confession of Faith, and the Negative Confession. In fact, this document forms the first part of the Scotland's National Covenant of 1638, which is pretty well known. It's a sort of a touchstone to determine a Protestant from a Catholic pretending to be a Protestant. And at least in the light of 20th century politics, it's hard to see this anything but a public relations ploy, but who knows. It was signed by the king, it was signed by John Craig, a number of the nobles, including Lennox, Esme Stewart, Morton, who was then in jail, and the greater part of the nobility and gentry throughout the kingdom. And it's a, well, it's not long compared to some of the other documents that we've gone through, but let me read a little bit at the beginning, and then I'm going to jump sort of to the end, or maybe to the middle. We all and every one of us under written protest that after long and due examination of our own consciences in matters of true and false religion, we are now thoroughly resolved in the truth by the Word and Spirit of God. And therefore we believe with our hearts, confess with our mouths, subscribe with our hands, and constantly affirm before God and the whole world that this only is the true Christian faith and religion, pleasing God and bringing salvation to man, which now is, by the mercy of God, revealed to the world by the preaching of the blessed evangel, and is received, believed, and defended by many and sundry notable kirks and realms, but chiefly by the Kirk of Scotland, the King's Majesty, and the three estates of this realm as God's eternal truth and only ground of our salvation, as more particularly expressed is expressed in the Confession of Faith established and publicly confirmed by sundry acts of Parliament, and now of a long time hath been openly professed by the King's Majesty, the whole body of this realm, both in burg and land. To the which confession and form of religion we willingly agree in our conscience in all points, and as unto God's undoubted truth and verity, grounded only upon His written word. So that's sort of the introduction. But and then it goes on. The longest part of it, I think, is denouncing Roman Catholicism. So, and therefore we abhor and detest all contrary religion and doctrine, but chiefly all kind of papistry in general, and particular heads, even as they are now damned and confuted by the word of God and Kirk of Scotland. But in special we detest and refuse the usurped authority of that Roman Antichrist upon the scriptures of God, upon the Kirk, the civil magistrate, and consciences of men, all his tyrannous laws made upon indifferent things against our Christian liberty, his erroneous doctrine against the sufficiency of the written word, perfection of the law, the office of Christ, and his blessed evangel, his corrupted doctrine concerning original sin, okay, and then it just goes on, from there it goes on and on, his five bastard sacraments, his blasphemous opinion of transubstantiation, his dispensations with solemn oaths, perjuries, and degrees of marriage forbidden in the word, his cruelty against the innocent divorced, his devilish mass, his blasphemous priesthood, his profane sacrifice for sins of the dead and the quick, canonizing men, calling upon angels and saints, purgatory, prayers to the dead, litany, multitude of advocates or mediators, and on it goes. So, in any case, they signed this document, and this is the same James who later, not too much later, wrote a letter to the Pope saying, well, although I haven't done much for you so far, it will not always be so. So James clearly sort of played both sides of the fence on the, politically speaking, and you know, one could argue from maybe a political standpoint that there were reasons for doing that, I won't get into that. Okay, well, this issue of bishops, of course, keeps coming to a head, and it's going to keep, it'll be a common problem throughout the rest of the class, actually. But in the, 25th of April, 1581, the General Assembly, meeting in Glasgow, they declared that they, first of all, they wholly condemned the estate of bishops as they existed in Scotland. They approved the organization of the church into one assembly, with one assembly, 18 synods, 50 presbyteries, and 600 parishes. And they ordained that the second book of discipline be registered in the Acts of the Church, and the copy should be taken by every presbytery. They also ratified the King's Confession, and they eliminated the office of reader, right, which we'll recall was one of those temporary and extraordinary offices that was just, it was now eliminated. So, because they had, at this point, they had enough ministers to fill the need.
Reader.
Let the record show that it was reader, not greeter. Okay, so shortly thereafter, the Archbishop of Glasgow died and left an opening, a vacuum, as it were, waiting to be filled. And Linux on opportunity, let's see, again quoting from King, for peculation of the fat revenues of the diocese, and made a successful search for a simoniac among the threadbare clergy. In Robert Montgomery, then minister of Stirling, he found a knave willing to dispone the wealth for the throne of a bishop, together with £83.06.08, some horse corn and poultry thrown in annually. A mere moiety, and yet not a bad bargain after all for a lay preacher who, during a strange vagabond ministry since the Reformation, had but £16 of stipend or thereby. So, again, there was a lot more money coming in, and the Earl of Lennox, the Esme Stuart, was hoping to collect that money. And so the king did what Esme Stuart desired, and he pointed Robert Montgomery to the bishopric of Glasgow. Well, the church wasn't very happy with this. First, the Glasgow Presbytery refused to implement the appointment. Okay, then the General Assembly confirmed the refusal, and they made themselves a party against the king. They went and complained. Kind of went back and forth several times, but at least one author noted that this Leith Concordat, which we talked about earlier, had not actually been revoked by the king. So it was basically an agreement between the king, I mean, Morton was the regent at the time, but he was acting on behalf of the king, between the king and the church, and the church had said, no, that's not how we do it, but both parties that had previously agreed and had not agreed to eliminate the office of bishop. So that it was certainly some of the problems here. Okay, so in April 1582,
yes. Was the king violating that?
No, he wasn't violating the Leith Concordat.
Okay.
Yeah, so
the church had agreed to that?
The church had agreed to it.
Okay.
And then, if you recall, Morton said, well, they agreed to it with a sort of very temporary type of thing, you know, saying that it would be, that this was imperfect and they want to come to a better resolution later. Morton finally said, well, you know, if you won't do this, what will you do? And that's when they wrote up the second book of discipline. And in any case, but there was still this written agreement, and that's what the king was relying on from a legal standpoint. Okay, so in April 1582, he again asserted his right to appoint the bishop. The church, meanwhile, had forbidden Montgomery to leave his charge in Stirling. Right, you couldn't just, if you were the minister of a church, you couldn't just go off someplace else without approval to do that. Right, you couldn't leave your charge. So, Montgomery was then, he was called to a meeting of the General Assembly at St. Andrew's in April, and they threatened to excommunicate him unless he submitted. He did, but then later on, sort of submitted then, and then later on he went to the, went to Glasgow and tried to, he evaded a meeting of the Presbytery with civil magistrates, I guess the police with him, and so he was excommunicated on the 10th of June, 1582. Well, that didn't make the king too happy, and particularly didn't make Esme Stuart very happy. They banished the preacher of St. Giles, John Dury, from Edinburgh. They banished him from Edinburgh for his comments from the pulpit on this matter. There were some other ministers that were speaking out that they were irritated with, but they just banished one. And this is a John Dury, kind of a colorful character. This is from James Hewson King again. A picturesque character, too, was he, when with an iron corselet for a cassock and a hagbutt musket for a pastoral staff, this beau ideal of the church militant marched down the Norlock banks in search of small game. I like that description. He was also, King also describes him as being a perfect spitfire of vituperation. His friend James Melville declared he was a very good fellow, but of small literature. Anyway, so he was a bit of a character. He was banished from Edinburgh. So when the assembly, they met again in June of 1582, they appointed a committee a group of men to represent them before the king, to deliver 14 complaints to the king. So the king apparently heard their complaints, but he replied on the 2nd of July with a official proclamation that Montgomery's excommunication was null and void, and instituting him in the office of bishop. Uh, Okay, so the assembly went back to meet with the king in Perth on the 6th of July, 1582, and the king and his court, so the Earl of Arran, Captain James Stewart, and Esme Stewart, the Earl of Lennox, were there. And this complaint was essentially an indictment of the king and council for interfering in the affairs of the church. So the Earl of Arran, who was this, we described before, sort of a unprincipled adventurer, he picked up their complaint. He said, "Who dares subscribe these treasonable articles?" And Andrew Melville answered, "We dare, we'll render our lives to the cause." And he stepped forward, and he pulled out a pen, or grabbed one from, I guess, from somebody nearby, and signed his name on this document. And the rest of the ministers then went and signed their names on the document. And this apparently overawed the king and his court. Some English observers thought that there were probably, they probably had like armed supporters nearby, being as bold as they were. So the king gave sort of a temporizing answer. Didn't really give them an answer, just stalled them for time. Okay, so at this point, they're reaching sort of a climax here. And in fact, Lennox was given a warrant to hold a chamberlain's court, and there he was going to inquire into the late sedition. This would be on the 27th of August. But on the 22nd of August, 1582, James was out hunting. He was invited to stay overnight at the castle of Gowrie. When he tried to leave in the morning, the master of Glamis, the noble, barred the door and told him, "You're not leaving." And the king finally started crying. Okay, so keep in mind he was, 16 at the time. Glamis said, "'Tis no matter of his tears. Better the bairn should weep than bearded men." So it wasn't a kidnapping as we might imagine today. It was basically an overthrow of the king's government, the people he'd set up around him. It was a kidnapping of sorts, but so, let's see. Dury, the minister who'd been exiled from Edinburgh, the one with the musket, he returned more like a moral general than a needy gospeler. And to the sound of 2,000 voices singing the 124th Psalm, which I guess this is the Scottish metrical version, "But blessed be God who doth us safely keep, and hath not given us for a living prey unto their teeth in bloody cruelty." So, at the sound of this singing, the Earl of Lennox was said to rent his beard. Okay, he had great ambition, but all his power was set on this fact that he was had the king in his thrall. And so, in fact, a few months later, he returned to France, and then he died, actually, not long after that. Okay, so, let's see, when the General Assembly met in October of 1582, the Lords had captured the king, sent a commission to explain their actions, and they said they were due to the dangers to which they perceived the church and religion, the king and his estate were exposed, and the confusion and disorder of the Commonwealth. And after some review of the matter, the assembly gave some sort of approval. I'm not really clear on what form that was, but both King and Hetherington say that the assembly gave them their approbation to the change of government. Okay, so the church, meanwhile, continued on the with the Reformation. This Montgomery fellow, he offered to submit, seeing the writing on the wall, he offered to submit to the church discipline, and he begged to again be received into communion. And then I think later on, he changed his tune again. But in any case, so everything was going well until the 26th of June, 1583, when the king managed to escape, which he was actually being held at Stirling Castle by then. And it wasn't the kind of close confinement that you might imagine him sitting in like a dungeon somewhere and then throwing food in. He'd gone out hunting, which is what got him into trouble in the first place. And he received some kind of message, and he rode as fast as he could for St. Andrews and to meet up with some other people. So, that's all the lecture material I have today. I have time for questions, and if we don't have questions, I have a discussion item from last week.
Questions?
Questions? You can ask other questions too. Go ahead.
How long did they keep it in the five colleges?
10 months, so.
Oh, less than a year.
Yeah, less than a year.
So
yeah, I may have been 17 when he escaped, so. Go back and look. But yeah, he's still, I think he, you know, to date he's been, you know, sort of your, typical teenager, but, you know, you can imagine a teenager that has all kinds of money and power and bad advice, bad company. You can imagine how impossible to deal with somebody like that would be. I think that's pretty much the story of James at this point. Now, it's said, I mean, one of his biographers that I was reading this week made the claim, and, you know, this is probably a good point, that this kidnapping, which, among other things, he basically had, in order for this kidnapping to work, he had to agree to it. And he did. I mean, he signed a proclamation that, you know, this was, you know, that the government needed reforming, and this reform was legitimate, and that he barred any sort of penalties being dealt out with the people who had kidnapped him, and so on. You know, obviously under some duress. But apparently his, this, what the biographer was pointing out, was that that this was sort of a continued lesson in life, something he kept with him throughout the rest of his life, and that was this his nature of dissimulating, you know, acting to various people differently depending on what he what he wanted the outcome to be, and manipulating. And he said he sort of learned this lesson very well, being in this captivity. He continued worshiping in Presbyterian form, even though supposedly when John Craig preached to him, he sometimes, you know, wept and so on, at least, not from sadness but from anger at the sort of preaching that was coming at him. Questions? Opinions? Okay, well, in that case then, we got a few minutes left. I wanted to come back to what we one of the questions that came up last week. Right, and this comes from this use of natural law by Buchanan. So when I read two quotes from him, right, and the first one, let's see, probably don't need to read the whole thing, but it came, Buchanan was explaining what he meant by nature, and he said that he wished it to be understood only as it means the light divinely shed upon our minds, and said that God gave us not only physical senses, but he also created in man's spirit a life by which he distinguishes between good and evil. Some call this ability nature and others the law of nature. I regard it as truly divine and am convinced that nature never says the one thing and reason the contrary. So furthermore, God has given us a summary which comprises the whole law in a few words. We should love him with all our souls and our neighbors as ourselves. Herein are contained all the rules of the Holy Scriptures which deal with moral conduct. Other than this is merely elaboration. Okay, and then later, right, I also read this quote, I won't read the whole thing, but referring to Maitland, who had referred to a verse from Romans, or maybe, I think he was referring to Romans 1, but I may not be right. He said, anyways, you do well, in my opinion, this is Buchanan speaking, to give so much weight to the authority of Paul that one sentence from him outweighs all the writings of the philosophers and legal experts. But see to it that you weigh his words with sufficient care. For it is important not only to look closely at his works, but also at his times, and to whom and for what purpose he wrote. Let us first see what Paul wrote. For he wrote to Titus, chapter 3, put them in mind to be subject to principalities and powers, to obey magistrates, and to be ready in all good works. You see, I think, the limits which Paul sets to the obligation to obey. He wrote in the second chapter of the epistle to Timothy to the same effect, that we pray for all men, especially for kings and other rulers, in order, he says, that we may lead a quiet life in all godliness and honesty. And here you see the purpose of our prayers as he describes it. It is not only the safety of kings, but the peace of the church, from which it is not difficult to conceive the form of the prayer. Okay. Anyways, he goes on from there arguing against antinomians and so on, but from, you know, attempting to argue from the Bible just what was our, you know, sort of due obedience to the magistrate and so on. So, the reason I read those passages last week is I wanted to point out that there's sort of a mix of what I would call natural law and, you know, biblical reasoning, and they're sort of bound up in the same document. So the question that was raised, or maybe this wasn't a question, this was an opinion, is that this was a compromise on Buchanan's part. And so I guess the question that I want to open for discussion, or the questions are, was this a compromise on Buchanan's part? And I guess in order to answer that, you probably have to keep in mind his education, his background. The word compromise may or may not be the right word. I think, yeah, it was grounded on both. But anyways, I'll leave that for discussion. And then also, what were the effects of this sort of mix of natural law and biblical reasoning? What would have been the historical effects? So that's my question for the class. So I've got a few ideas, but otherwise I'll just keep going on. So go ahead.
Well, if you think about, you know, the issue of compromise, it sort of struck me, if we go through this, that there's this mixture of politics and church that really they haven't been able to get it apart, pull it apart. So to write political, you have to write a political treatise in theological terms, or it didn't even make any sense, I suspect. So it's not clear to me how he compromised. He could have diluted his purely political thesis with theological terms in order to make a point. Or he could have diluted his purely theological treatise with sort of rational reasoning to make a point. But it seems to me that this is a problem that this whole culture really has. And I'm not sure which is worse. Well, is it worse to live with a benevolent pagan who you know is completely on the other side, or is it worse to have this sort of halfway mixture of politics and theology?
Right.
I would say that during their time that they were the only rational
talking about God creating man and not only giving him his physical senses, okay, by which he can avoid all that endangers him and can maintain situations favorable to his well-being. Okay, so sort of, but he also created in his spirit a life by which he distinguishes between good and evil. Some call this ability nature, and others the law of nature. I regard it as truly divine and am convinced that nature never says the one thing and reason the contrary. Okay, then he goes on to say, but that's the part you're referring to, where he's sort of assuming that, I think that's right, assuming that the non-Christian would have some sort of, intuition as to how to be able to set up a political system.
Right, it was an appeal to the humanists of the day who were sort of rebelling against the church in intellectual fashion. This is what I'm getting here, but
Well, I would say
that I think historically it was something that the church, I think the church made a mistake in that regard and continued to follow that idea of appealing to natural laws on the basis of common rational thinking, assuming that the non-Christians agree with that because the thoughts were correct, logically rational. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I think later on that does come out, but I don't see it so much in, actually I see it much less in Scottish church history than maybe,
Well, certainly after the 19th century.
Yeah, in the 19th century, but...
So I'm kind of looking at this, is this a precursor to that? Is this...
Yeah. It might be, but I think, I guess one of the things about calling it a compromise implies that...
I didn't say compromise personally.
Yeah, okay. well, I mean, I think if you keep in mind his education, right, he would have been raised very much in the sort of, you call it humanistic, not in quite as pejorative sense as we might use the word today, but certainly his education would have been largely grounded on this sort of thinking. And so, possible. It's possible that he wasn't totally reformed in that sense. Rob's right. Certainly, natural law thinking is still with us today, and it still is problematic. But I guess in terms of where they were at, it doesn't seem to me that it was represent some kind of conscious, change on Buchanan's part. I think he was actually trying to. Probably, it was coming the other way. It was adopting more biblical thinking. And a lot of the philosophical issues.
What year was Grant?
Let's see. What years was Erasmus writing? Well, it would have been around the same time frame. I mean, Erasmus was a contemporary of Calvin, right? So, Calvin. Yeah, I can't remember what year Calvin died, but I mean, it would have been the general time frame, maybe not for that. Believe me, Erasmus is particularly the Erastian view of civil government is a major theme of Scottish church history. What about the effects of this? Rob's already pointed out in the 19th century, although whether or not it came from Buchanan or whether or not it came from other sources, but that this sort of thing became more of a problem. But I was wondering about what the effects might have been closer to that. And I sort of had two ideas, just I'll throw out. One might have been, keep in mind, Buchanan was James's teacher. So perhaps James's education was somehow, maybe this had some influence. I don't know. I mean, it's purely speculative on my part. Also, it may certainly have later encouraged those who attempted to set up democracy based solely on a natural law basis, right? I mean, that was, even if Buchanan's, as Otto Scott said, Buchanan's name had faded, I think probably, some people did take some parts of that and used it, separated it more than Buchanan had. Anyway, so that's a couple ideas. I don't know if you have other ideas on
when did John Hawthorne write?
Later?
Yeah, later.
So, I mean, he would have been... I can't say whether or not Locke read Buchanan and took some of his ideas from there, but that wouldn't be... I mean, if I had to guess, I would say that would be one of the people who...
I would contrast it with Rutherford, who seemed to be a little bit more straight theological, biblical law, so maybe not as well developed. He didn't have a... It's probably a detail political theory. But then Locke came along and sort of
Knox had, Knox. Rutherford had a pretty detailed political theory. But in fact, the copy of Lex Rex that I have, the first part is Samuel Rutherford Lex Rex. And in the bound in with it is Buchanan's De Jure Regni. Yeah, I mean, that's just what the printer did in the 1800s. But I mean, that, it was some logic. He had some logical reason for doing that. But
then Locke made it even more based on actual similar ideas.
Yeah. Did you remember when we had the first class, we talked about Cunningham's discussion of how a lot in church history, things are really unclear until people actually argue it out? And I kind of think with Buchanan at this point, we're sort of before that point, and before the sort of to the extent that later on people like Locke took just the natural law, that was definitely a problem. But my guess is at this point it certainly wouldn't have been clear that this was the outcome of using any natural law theory.
And he had Aquinas, right?
Way before
that. So this was natural law was well established.
Oh, yeah.
So in a sense, he was perhaps edging the other way. And did Rutherford follow him then, or was he before him?
No, Rutherford, we'll get to Rutherford.
Okay.
Rutherford wrote in the 1630s, 1620s, and he died somewhere around 1640.
Yeah. So perhaps he's going the other way. Maybe if you start from Aquinas and move to where Buchanan is,
Althusius was probably one of the first of the Spanish jurists that were, or so I don't think, Aquinas. They may have read him and used him, but he said he was so foundational. I don't know that he was that influential. You know what I'm saying? It would be like us respecting C.S. Lewis and some of the things he says, but he's in the heart, but he wouldn't necessarily base the political theory off of what he said. He based it off of what somebody else heard later.
You don't believe that the children of the sons of Adam and daughters of Eve theory of political teaching?
I mean, my take on it would be that Mike.
Can I ask a question off the subject?
Please.
It appeared that King James was trying to elevate the bishopric.
The name Robert Montgomery.
Yeah, Montgomery. The church excommunicated and stopped it, and then the king reversed it. It looks to me like right there you're fighting over who has all the power in the church. But the king can reverse my communication that he's saying.
Oh, yeah. This is.
Right.
Depends what year you look at. Yeah, he did. Or, I mean, he proclaimed to. Yeah. Now, and they did not excommunicate him solely to prevent him from being bishop. I mean, he had other grounds for doing it. But, But yeah, I mean, you could look at it that way. No, I think you're certainly right. In fact, this, I've read a bunch of histories of the times and so on, and this is, I think, in more than one book called The Fight for Prerogative. You know, basically it's the church and the state fighting for this, who's going to be the top dog on ecclesiastical issues. But now also what the detractors of the church would say is that the church is also trying to be the top dog on political issues. But I would disagree with that. Primarily, there may have been a few cases where they meddled in politics, but I think by and large they try to stay out of it.
If you were out of the church, you were out of politics.
Well, the church man.
Yeah, there were several things right that tied it together, but I think I would say primarily they tried to keep their political sort of stuff to those issues that they were directly affected by, like this excommunication. Well, if you call that meddling in politics, then of course they meddled in politics. The church lands, the benefices, and so on, that was one of their issues. But I tell you, you know, I think they otherwise tried to stay out of politics. I'm not sure they were always successful. And there were reasons like the church lands and the appointment of bishops and so on that it was somewhat unavoidable. This, the Earl of Ruthven after he'd captured the king, you know, he sent this disputation over, deputation over to the General Assembly, sort of seeking their approval for this action, which he got sort of. So that might have been partly meddling in politics, but at the same time, you know, you have to keep in mind that the outcome of all this wasn't known, and you know, in terms of the church, you can say it shouldn't meddle in politics, but if you look at the possible alternative being takeover by a Catholic sovereign or something like that, and you know, the massacre of St. Bartholomew in your country, St. Bartholomew's Day in your country, then I think you can understand why they would have been very tempted to meddle in politics, and how, you know, it was difficult to distinguish, but I think they tried to some extent to stay out of it. But
the church
had a certain animating. You know, the church certainly couldn't call the shots, but certainly the church's opinion on the matter probably would. They would sway whether or not the Lords would be successful, or they could.
So. I was just going to say, is that not the reading of the position they're in right now? Is that not the correct position? In fact, the church has a lot more sway than the city.
I would say so, and I would say in our time, right, the civil government's figured out this way to sort of reduce the church's influence down to almost nothing by sort of, I mean, you could look at it as a sort of question of drawing boundaries over what the church might properly do, and what might be said from the pulpits, you know, but, you know, we certainly expect the pastor to speak out on, you know, adultery and fornication and lying and stealing and so on. You know, should he speak out on it when the government is doing it? We would say yes. But, you know, you can look at our civil government today, and, you know, they try to actually, if somebody who's conservative tries to do that, then they try to revoke their tax exempt status. So.
Actually, I think the biblical model would be that the church is going to have to try and turn their own different. When the decisions are judged, they would think it's the church. Biblically. I don't know that it was ever followed, but they were supposed to go to the Levite and say, "What's your decision on that?" And then they had to follow their decision. So the church just has to influence the final court of appeal in case there are two difficulties in the magistrate.
Okay, well, let me just, we better stop now. Okay. But, yeah, I think a lot of the issues that you're raising are the issues that they keep coming back, and I don't expect that we're going to get to the final definitive answer in this class. I think we're going to see how various views work themselves out. So, let's see. Mike, would you close in prayer?